Thanks for listening to the Movement Church Podcast. Movement is located in Newport, Kentucky, and you're always welcome to join us on a Sunday morning at 10:30. Hope you enjoy this podcast.
You guys can be seated. And while you do, give this this awesome band up here a hand. Yeah, you're pretty good. No, it's a daff. I don't, there you go. All right, hey, first through fifth graders, you guys are getting out of here. You're going down there with the dynamic duo, Scott and Andrew, right now. You guys are going to have a blast down there. So we're in this series, and we're asking some big questions. And so this is the big question for this morning. What if God doesn't care? What if God doesn't care about what I'm going through? Why would I believe in a God who's heartless? Why would I choose to believe in a God who doesn't show up when I need him? Now, I think that this is a very common question. I think that when I think about people who express hesitancy, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to struggle with words. English is, yeah. Who have a hesitancy about believing in God. I think it's so often built around this question. Why would I believe in a God who isn't there for me? Why would I believe in a God who's so heartless? I think this is a genuine question. I think this isn't a question about winning an argument, about proving someone wrong or trying to convince somebody of something, but I think this is a question born of pain, a question born of suffering. It's a question that speaks to our kind of shared condition. It's a question that speaks to us wanting something more, for us to experience love and worth, to have a purpose. It speaks to the idea that we are looking for something. It speaks to us, this idea that we want to have a relationship with God. We recognize that there is this distance, that there is this questioning that we have, there is this longing that we have. And for us, we say, well, if I'm supposed to be with this God, if I'm supposed to be connected to this God, then of course, why wouldn't this God show up in my life? See, this question of why would I believe in a heartless God is something that's at the cornerstone. It's at the kind of the crucial level of what I would call orthodox Christian belief. When I say orthodox Christian belief, what I'm saying is these are things that we kind of all believe about God, that we can find commonality with people of all sorts of different denominational background, all sorts of different cultural background, that I could sit down with a Roman Catholic, I could sit down with a Greek Orthodox, I could even sit down with a Southern Baptist, okay? I can sit down with people of all different stripes and have agreement on this. And this simple kind of idea of God, it has these three kind of big ideas of who God is and what God is able to do is this, that God is all-powerful, that God is all-knowing, and that God is all-loving. These three kind of core beliefs about who God is. Now, I can sense that these are things that maybe you're familiar with, maybe that you have heard before. He would have all three of these things. But in fact, I've heard people who don't believe in God look at those three and say, well, you can't have all three. You got to pick two. You can only pick two. See, you have to pick two, because if you say that he is all-knowing and all-powerful, he must not love us. He must not love us, because if he knows something's going to happen, he could do something about it, but he doesn't. That means he lacks love. He could be all-powerful. He could be all-loving, but he must not know that things are coming. They've blindsided God. You can't have all three. You have to pick two. But when we look at the Bible, we see the God of the Bible. What we see over and over again is that God is portrayed as having all three of these qualities. And in this series, what we've seen time and time again is that people have these common objections, these understandable objections to belief in God. I want to believe, but. I want to believe, but. And this question that follows speaks to this issue that we have where we have added things on to our understanding of God. Well-intentioned people like myself have tried to make it more palpable, may try to make it a little easier to swallow, to take in. We have kind of taken it, we've dumbed it down sometimes, we've watered it down sometimes, we've tried to make sense in our own understanding and pass that on, and in doing so, we're not passing on a truly biblical, truly full understanding of who God is. So if we look at kind of a review of this series, and you can get on our podcast, our website, our app, and listen to all this stuff, and I'd recommend that you do, but we started off on week one talking about the on-demand God. God would show up when I need him now. He would provide what I need now. We kind of have this one singular statement that summed that up. We said that God doesn't exist to serve us. We exist to serve him. God doesn't exist to serve us. He's not there to meet every demand. It's not this genie situation. It's not like just providing everything we need. God does not exist to serve us. We exist to serve him. Week two, we talked about this idea of the killjoy God. The killjoy God. I would believe in God, but I want to live my life. I don't want to have to worry about this list of things I can't do, and if I do one of those things wrong, then I am on the outside. I don't want to have to worry about if I am towing the line properly. And when I'm around other Christians who seem to live by these rules, they are not fun to be around. They are lifeless. They are lame. They are dead inside. Why would I want to be around those people? And we said kind of this huge dichotomy that we see in Scripture, I see in my life, I think we see today, is that we have a battle between the bad news of religion that says there are rules, there are things you have to do to get connected with God, versus the good news of Jesus that says Jesus allows us to connect despite what we've done, not because of what we're doing, that whatever is in our past, whatever mistakes, regrets, pain, hardship, heartache, whatever is there, that's not going to prevent us from connecting with God, that we can connect with God because of what Jesus has done, not because of our own efforts, our own will. And then last week we talked about the goosebump God, this emotional God. I need to feel God. And we simply said you can't trust your emotions. You can't trust your emotions. You have to understand that God is at work, that God has a higher level of thing, and those emotions are there. You should celebrate those emotional connections with God, but you can't base your entire understanding, your entire pursuit of God, your following Jesus on those emotions. And this brings us to today. This fourth, and I think probably the most common and the most powerful and the most divisive question that we ask ourselves. I want to believe in God, but why would I believe in a heartless God? This is this incredible moment, this incredible idea that kind of divides us between belief in God and fully taking that step. To illustrate this is an idea that something that's kind of universal. I want to look at John the Baptist. John the Baptist, this is what you need to know, and I'm gonna call him by his little nickname that I made up, JTB. You know, you can steal that for yourselves. But John the Baptist, JTB, is this guy. My wife didn't like that joke, and neither did you, and I can understand why, because it was a bad one. So John the Baptist, he's the forerunner to Jesus, all right? He's Jesus' cousin. He's going to come along, he's older than Jesus, and he's going to go out and he's going to preach this message of repentance. So John the Baptist's whole thing was that he is going to challenge people to turn back to a life that is reflective, that is honoring, that is faithful to the Scriptures. John the Baptist, as his name implies, baptizes people out in the middle of nowhere. Now John the Baptist is a kook. He's a weirdo. Okay, you may know this, that he wore a cloak made of camel hair, which you don't go to the store and buy anything of camel hair. This is not a soft, you know, like breathable material, right? So he is wearing this camel hair cloak. He's eating locusts and wild honey. Like everybody has a family member that kind of fits this bill, right? This is the family member that has a lot of opinions on the banking system, right? They're the ones that send you the emails with wanting you to forward that on to someone else. They're the ones that always seem to have something they're working on, something cooking up that they're not really, I'm not really sure how they make money, but they seem to do pretty well, and they've got this, they've got that, and they just kind of go through life. They're just kind of this operating on a different level. This is John the Baptist. John the Baptist is that weird cousin, right? And obviously he's baptizing people, but as for as weird as John the Baptist is, he does the right thing. He is creating this opportunity. He's kind of plowing the ground before Jesus comes and puts the seed down. And John the Baptist is preparing people for the message of Jesus. And so he's out there, and he's a rabble-rouser. He's somebody who's picking fights. He's calling people out. And he eventually gets caught up in this political kind of intrigue with Herod, the Jewish king that's propped up by the Romans, who has kind of nominal control over the area. And Herod is this bloodthirsty guy. He's killing his sons. He's killing brothers. He's taking out political rivals before they can even manifest themselves. And Herod takes a fancy to his murdered brother's former wife and marries his ex-sister-in-law or his former sister-in-law. And John the Baptist calls this out. He says, this isn't right. This is wrong. And he's preaching about this. And so John the Baptist finds himself in jail. And there in jail, doing everything right. Like he may have needed to, you know, speak a little bit more clearly or at the right time, but John the Baptist goes for it. He's bold, he's brash. He's in jail. And he has this moment where his followers, his disciples are visiting him. And he has them go and ask Jesus, is this really what's going to happen? Is this the moment? Imagine if you're John the Baptist. You've seen Jesus, your cousin, do incredible things. You are John the Baptist. Your cousin is Jesus. You have done everything right. You had a role to play. You played it flawlessly. You step back. You allow Jesus to take the stage, to take the credit, to get the attention. And now you're sitting in jail. You're expecting something powerful to happen, right? You're thinking, if anybody deserves to get saved, to be broken out of jail for Angel Team 6 to come bursting in and do whatever they do and bring them out, like this is John the Baptist. He's the perfect candidate for this. And he's rotting away in jail. And so he gets his disciples together and he basically says, go and talk to Jesus. Say, what's the holdup? And so in Matthew chapter 14, starting in verse 2, it'll be on the screen. We see kind of how this plays out. Verse 2 gives us the context. It says, when John, who was in prison, heard about the deeds of the Messiah, he sent his disciples to ask him, are you the one who is to come, or should we expect someone else? John the Baptist saying, he's like, what's the holdup? I thought this was how it was going to work. I thought you were going to fix this. I'm in prison. I'm your cousin. I'm your family. I did everything right. Why aren't you showing up? In verse 4, Jesus replied. He says this, go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight. The lame walk. Those who have leprosy are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead are raised. And the good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me. John is sitting here wondering, what is the end game? John is wondering, what is the holdup? And what does Jesus say? Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me. Jesus is basically saying, hey, this is how it is. I'm doing my mission. I hope this isn't too big of a problem for you, but I'm moving ahead. If I'm John and I hear that, I'm pretty upset. I take that as a slap in the face. I take that as a sign of disrespect. I take that as a sign of Jesus saying, I'm done with you. I'm giving up on you. I'm taking that as a sign that you don't care. Jesus is doing his thing. He's pursuing his mission. John the Baptist is rotting in prison. John the Baptist, the phrase, put his head on a silver platter comes from this moment because John the Baptist is beheaded. He's executed. And he dies. And I think John the Baptist was asking, God, don't you care? If you've ever asked that, if you've ever in the face of desperation, ever in the face of tragedy that feels like it's crushing you, in that moment where you don't know what to do, you don't know if you're going to get your next breath, in that moment where you sense, why is this happening to me? What did I do wrong? Why is that jerk, that cheater, that person who's lazy, why are they getting ahead? Why is it that they get this good stuff and I'm stuck here? Why did they get promoted and I didn't? Why did their marriage stay together and mine failed? Why am I bankrupt and why are they doing so well? If you've ever asked that question, let me tell you up front, you're not alone. Let me also tell you this, I'm not here to answer those questions. I've had those questions. I will have those questions, and so will you, and so have you. But what I want to show you today, two big thoughts, things to embrace, truths to remember in those moments when we feel as though everything's pressing down upon us, when we can't get answers to the diagnosis, when we can't get a way forward, when we can't get ahead. Every time we take a step, we feel like we're pulled back four. And when we can't get ahead, let us remember these two things. If you're taking notes, the first big thought is this. When God doesn't seem fair, remember, number one, that God always has a purpose in your pain. Now, before you jump ahead of me, I'm not saying that God is purposefully inflicting pain on you. I don't think that's how God operates. I'm not saying that God is causing the pain that is so tormenting you. I'm not saying that God gave you that disease, gave you that failed relationship, gave you that bankruptcy, gave you that pink slip. I'm not saying that. In fact, I don't believe that's how God operates. But what I am saying is, in the midst of that, God is not done with you. There is still a purpose. So he is good. Even when you're hurting, God is still working. So whatever the pain is, no matter how big, no matter how small, God still has work that he is pulling you forward to. God is still at work. The Apostle Peter experiences all sorts of pain, all sorts of frustration. The Apostle Peter was the one that when Jesus was arrested, this leader of the 12 was the one who denied that he knew Jesus when a teenage girl asked him if he was associated, if he knew, if he was a part of that Jesus movement. Peter was the one that experiences the persecution and the pain and the literal pain and the literal execution as he is martyred because of his beliefs, that he doesn't get to die in his bed surrounded by loved ones peacefully. He dies on a cross upside down to prove a mocking point about his beliefs. Peter knows pain. In 1 Peter, one of his letters, he writes this in chapter 1, verses 6 through 7. He says this, "In all this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed." That's from one translation of the Bible. I want to read a larger section from another translation of the Bible, the Message version. It says this, this translates as thus. It says, "What a God we have, and how fortunate we are to have him. This Father of our Master Jesus, because Jesus was raised from the dead, we have been given a brand new life and have everything to live for, including a future in heaven. And the future starts now. God is keeping careful watch over all of us and the future. The day is coming when you have it all, life healed and whole. I know how great this makes you feel, even though you have put up with every kind of aggravation in the meantime. Pure gold put in the fire comes out of it proved gold. Genuine faith put through this suffering comes out proved genuine. When Jesus wraps this all up, it's your faith, not your gold, that God will have on display as evidence of his victory. You never saw him, yet you loved him. You still don't see him, yet you trust him with laughter and singing. Because you kept on believing, you'll get what you're looking forward to, total salvation." And those challenges, in that moment of pain, in that moment of frustration, that suffering does something to our faith. I think it's almost like a tree that in the midst of a drought, well, the roots will go deeper seeking out moisture. The roots will go deeper and will strengthen. In the midst of challenges, I think our faith, the roots of our faith go deeper and become stronger. There's something that happens through adversity, through challenge, that makes us better when we come out of the other side. We often will look back on a time and say, "I wouldn't go through that again if you paid me," but there was something positive that came out of it. There was something good about it. It could be August two-a-days for football. It could be rushing at a fraternity sorority. It could be boot camp. It could be a family reunion. It could be walking with a loved one through illness, through hospice, through the following grief, through the days and the weeks, the months and the years after the funeral. That whatever it is, this adversity forges those important relationships stronger. The same is true with our faith. And that Message translation translates this idea of the ultimate goal as total salvation. Total salvation. I love that line. Total salvation. Completely and totally saved. That things are made right. You know what isn't right? You know what isn't right? Cancer. Earthquakes. Hurricanes. Racism. School shootings. Child abuse. Heart disease. Alzheimer's. Parkinson's disease. ALS. Parents having to bury their children. The list could go on. We could make that list a lot longer, but in total salvation, these things are gone. We're not there yet. We're not there yet. But when we look at the scriptures, we look at the Bible, we see this kind of crazy vision that the Apostle John has. And he writes them down in what we have is the book of Revelation. And the book of Revelation ends with this glorious picture of how things are going to end up. In Revelation chapter 21, starting in verse 3, John says this. He says, I heard a voice thunder from the throne. Look, look, God has moved into the neighborhood, making his home with men and women. They're his people. He's their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death is gone for good. Tears gone. Crying gone. Pain gone. All the first order of things gone. The enthroned continued. Look, I'm making everything new. We're not there yet, but we're on the way. The incredible gift of Jesus, besides the idea that we can connect with God, besides the idea that he sacrificed himself out of love for you and I, besides all of that, is that we get to see what awaits us. See, the idea that Jesus was buried, he was dead, he comes out alive in the resurrection on Easter Sunday, this is this grand preview for us to see what's coming. That we will be made right, that we will be made whole. We will be fully alive as Jesus was post-resurrection. This is the grand promise of the Bible. This is the grand finale. This is the total salvation that John speaks of here. And what we see over and over again is that God is not done with us in the midst of our pain. The second thing, the second truth that I want you to take with you is this. Is that God is always present in your pain. I think that the hardest part of adversity, of pain, of challenge, of chaos, of tragedy, is this sense that you're alone. This sense that you're alone. I've had the true honor of doing quite a few funerals, of officiating funerals. I've done more funerals than weddings, and I don't know what that says about me, but, you know, whatever. But I do love doing a funeral. I love the idea of I can truly love that family in this moment. And what I have found over and over again is I'm standing kind of off to the side, the casket's up here, the family's there, the receiving line's coming out. I'm standing over here, and I can hear what's said. And I see people coming down. They mean so well. But they say some of the most ridiculous things to the family, don't they? In the midst of that grief, we don't know what to say. We don't know what to say to the grieving, to those who have experienced such loss. And so we say the first thing that comes to our head, and let me tell you, from experience, I know that's not always a good thing. But what I have found is those families, they're grieving, they're tired, they've got all these things they're trying to take, they're trying to juggle, the family drama and the estate and what we're going to do, and where's everybody going after this? The most ridiculous things are said to them. You know what they do? They say thanks. They nod. They shake hands. They give hugs because they want to feel that people are with them in this. Even people like me who don't even know what to say. That they want to feel as though they are not alone. They are not alone. I love the concept of awake. Our Roman Catholic brothers and sisters, I think, get this right. This idea that when someone dies, the family, the friends, they gather together. We're going to spend all night together. There's going to be good food, and there's going to be good drink. And we're going to cry, but we're also going to laugh. We're going to tell stories, and we're going to talk about what ifs, but we're going to enjoy that. I love that idea that we're not going to let these people be alone, even for this first night. You know, maybe you're going through something, and you feel alone. You know, you've shared what's going on. You've kind of put yourself out there, and you feel like people aren't responding the way you need them to. Maybe that feeling of shame, of guilt that's associated with this makes you feel like you need to isolate yourself. You need to withdraw. You need to step back. Well, let me tell you this. We're not a guilt and shame kind of church. And we can't probably fix the problem as easily or as neatly as you would wish or we would wish. But we can provide comfort. We can show up. We can be that relationship. We can be there for you. We can listen. We can pray for you. Because we believe that God is always present. That God is always present, especially in the pain. The Apostle Paul. We spent so much of this past summer talking about the Apostle Paul and all the ways that he went around the Mediterranean rim and established churches, and his legacy is just so, so crucial. And what we see in the Apostle Paul is that he had incredible sufferings. He goes through this laundry list of things that people attacked him, that he was attempted to be stoned to death. There was beatings. He was run out of town. He was shipwrecked. He was snake bitten. He was all these things in prison, all of these things. And he talks about one of these things, this thorn in his side. We're not sure what this thorn is. We don't know if it's a person, if it's a condition, if it's what it is. We don't know what it is, but the Apostle Paul says this in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. He says, "There three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in my weakness.'" I feel like there's times where God will say to me, "My grace is sufficient for you." And I'm like, "Yeah, kind of, but not really. Why don't you give me a little bit more? You could show up, and that'd be awesome if you did." And Paul does what I don't do. He says something. He starts talking crazy. The next verse, he says, "Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties, for when I am weak, then I am strong." That there's this idea that God is with us, empowering us, enabling us to move forward. And Paul embraces the pain, embraces the suffering. He stops trying to run from it. He stops trying to minimize what's going on. "I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do that perfectly. But I see that Paul is doing it." He starts to look for what God is up to. He believes that God is there and that God has a purpose, and he's going to see where that goes. Did God give you that diagnosis? Did God cause your kids to rebel? Did God give you that roommate from hell? Did God give you the addiction? Did God cause you to go bankrupt? Did God gift you that mental illness? No, but he's in it. He's in it with you. He's there. He's there. I think that we often try to live that Instagram life. We just want to capture that perfect moment. We want that moment right now to be perfect. We want everything to be figured out. And so I would encourage you to stop looking for the perfect moment and realize that following Jesus, living a life that's a journey, it's a process, realize that God is not done with you, realize that God is in it, and maybe for you, you need to look back and you need to see what God has been up to and understand where you need to go moving forward. Realize that God has shown up. I often pick on the Psalms and the poetry of the Bible because I'm a big dumb animal, but there's a lot of truth in that too. There's a lot of truth in this heartfelt understanding. And Psalm 103, verse 8 says this. It says, "The Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love. He will not always accuse, nor will he harbor his anger forever. He does not treat us as our sins deserve, or repay us according to our iniquities. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his love for those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west," or I should say, "the east is from the west. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us." I'm going to invite the band to come up, and I want to tell you a story as they're getting ready to lead us, as the band comes up to lead us in the last songs. But one of my earliest memories as a kid, I was asking my mom about this yesterday. She says I was like two and a half when this happened. And we were at my uncle's. He was just down the road. He has a horse farm, and and we were down there, and my mom was probably riding, and I was in a cowboy stage, as kids do. Had my cowboy hat, had my rope, and I loved to lasso things. Well, I was going to lasso one of my aunt and uncle's dogs, except the dog was sleeping. His dog's name was Sam, and Sam was this beautiful, huge, very loving, very gentle Rottweiler. And I remember, well, I don't remember, but the bits and pieces I remember of this leading up to it was I was going to lasso Sam. And apparently, I don't remember this, but apparently I stepped on his paw. And when I did, Sam reacted, he freaked out, he reached up, and he got a hold of my ear, and he nearly ripped my ear off. And in that moment, I've been told this after the fact, all I remember is being in pain at that moment, but after the fact that mom and dad are rushing me to the hospital, and mom's having to tell her brother not to shoot the dog, it was an accident, that whole thing. But what I do remember is this. I remember laying on this table in the doctor's office, probably in the immediate care, maybe the ER, I don't know. And my mom and my dad holding me down. Holding me down as they stitched up my ear. In the moment, I couldn't believe that my parents were doing that. But they had to. And they did that out of love. I couldn't believe that my parents wouldn't stop the pain. But they were. I just had to go through some pain to get there. Now, that's one of my earliest memories. That could totally change my view of my parents, but it doesn't, because I understood that that was what they had to do in that moment. I don't believe that God is heartless. I don't think God is heartless, but I know those moments when it feels like it. When it feels as though God is absent. And I would tell you these two things. God is not done with you in those moments. And we see over and over again in the Bible, in the scriptures, that when people call out, when people are in need, when they cry out to God, God hears, God is present. God is not heartless. Let's pray. God, we are often so confused.